Welcome to Season 5 of the Precision Medicine Podcast, sponsored by Trapelo. This is the podcast where experts come to discuss the problems oncologists, reference labs, and payers face as precision medicine grows and consider solutions for advancing the quality of patient-centered cancer care. Be sure to subscribe at precisionmedicinepodcast.com to get the latest episodes delivered straight to your inbox.
Welcome back. I'm Karen Cushman, your host and producer, and today I am thrilled to announce that this marks our 60th episode of the Precision Medicine Podcast. So a quick but very sincere thank you to all of our listeners, both here in the U.S. and across the globe, which I think now is about over 120 countries. We also want to thank our past guests and, of course, our sponsors. And so I'm honored today to celebrate our 60th episode with a guest who really embodies all of the reasons that the podcast exists. So let's get right to it. Our guest today has been living with stage 4 colorectal cancer since March of 2018. In that time, he has undergone 7 major surgeries, chemotherapy, immunotherapy, and a clinical trial. He is the founder and CEO of Man Up to Cancer, a support community that inspires men to come out of their man caves to connect and avoid isolation during their cancer journeys. As a patient leader, he's received the Annette Cook Cancer Warrior Award and the Amanda Dempsey Award. In his professional life, he's an accomplished journalist and now author of Open Heart, Warrior Spirit, A Man's Guide to Living with Cancer. Trevor Maxwell, thanks for joining me today on the Precision Medicine Podcast.
Oh my goodness, Karen, it is great to join you. You make me sound much more accomplished than I am in my own mind. So thank you for that. Thank you for the generous introduction.
You're welcome. Well, I appreciate your time. We've been talking about this episode for some time, so I'm excited to kick it off. And so I want to start with just giving our listeners sort of a state of affairs in colorectal cancer today. Yeah. With a few statistics, and feel free to jump in. I'm actually going to layer in a little context from our most recent episode with Dr. Douglas Flora as well. So the American Cancer Society reports that people over 50 now have a 50% greater chance of being diagnosed for colorectal cancer than they had in the 90s, making colorectal cancer one of the deadliest cancers for middle-aged people. And as I mentioned, Dr. Douglas Flora was with us recently. He's a community oncologist in a part of the country that has the highest incidence of cancer in America. And he shared that what's alarming is that we're really just not effectively screening for colon cancer in about 80% of patients younger than 60. So Trevor, as you know, as someone who has and is continuing to walk in the shoes of a patient facing colorectal cancer, what is your advice and your view on screening? What options are out there and what advancements exist for middle-aged patients?
Yeah. I mean, first of all, let me just say, I'm really glad we're talking about this. You know, this is, I think society is finally, we're finally starting to get some momentum in awareness around colorectal cancer, particularly around the rise in young onset colorectal cancer. And I'm just going to say CRC for the rest of the show, if that's okay.
Sounds good.
Yeah, just saves time. So the fact that we're talking about CRC, we're talking about the rise in young onset. I mean, that is, I was diagnosed at age 41. So the ages between 18 and 45 or 18 and 50 are really kind of my wheelhouse where I'm spending most of my time in advocacy and talking about screening protocols and all that stuff. Because as Dr. Flora mentioned in your show, the startling statistic and the one that should just slap us in the faces is young onset CRC. So a person born in 1990 has twice the risk of colon cancer and 4 times the risk of rectal cancer as a person born in 1950. And right. And it's already, so CRC has surpassed, it's number one in terms of the leading cancer killer for men under 50 and the second leading cancer killer for women under 50, right behind breast cancer. So this should be shocking to us, you know, a 1-3% increase in the young onset cohort every year when over 50, you know, and I'm concerned about CRC at any age. Don't get me wrong. I care about all of the people who will be diagnosed and will die from this disease. But it's the older population where, you know, increase of awareness of colonoscopy, of screening, of Cologuard and other methods, fit test for testing, they are the ones that have been flat or declining in terms of incidence and death. And So I really want to shine a light, and I'm thanking you because I really do want to shine a light on what is happening with young onset CRC, and specifically the question that's not being asked. You know, we're spending a lot of time on awareness. We're spending a lot of time and money on treatments and in other areas, but why is this happening? Right? That's what I want everyone to be asking ourselves. What are some of the root causes for this increase? And there's lots of theories out there. People are talking about, of course, diet, but there's lots of other things going on outside of diet and sedentary lifestyles. There's differences now that, you know, didn't exist in that prior generation or generations. We're looking at microplastics and antibiotics and all kinds of different areas that could be contributing to this. And we also see it worldwide. So I really just want to put out there, we need to focus as a society on answering that question. And there's even some thought that this is distinct biologically, in terms of when we look at CRC in younger people. So why is this happening and what can we do to prevent it? And then secondly, into your question, which, I'm getting a long way around to, which is how do we screen for it?
Yeah, I just want to, before you get into that, just add, it is the third most prevalent cancer in the world.
Yeah.
Just for some added context there. So,
and I love our breast cancer warriors. We are right with them. But in terms of awareness and in terms of spending on research, like they have taken the ball and run with it, right? And I think as CRC advocates, we're just saying, you know, we also need to be looked at here. And I think even a generation ago, talking about breast cancer was really difficult. People would talk about chest cavity cancer or chest cancer because it wasn't okay to talk about it in public. Mm-hmm. What I want to see is it being okay for people to talk about colorectal cancer on an equal footing with breast cancer. And I hope we're getting there.
So how do you think we get more folks in for screening? And is that the issue? Is it just awareness? Is it going to your appointments? I mean, we've been talking a lot, you know, since COVID, it's just about getting people back in for regular appointments and the instance of cancer going up because people weren't going in. So we're kind of past that. But is it the stigma? You know, what yeah. is it? You know, what is the issue in screening? Why is it 80%?
You raise a lot of good questions, and I'll give you my take on it. And remember, I'm a patient. So I'm a patient leader. I have learned as much as possible as a layperson over the past 6 years. I'm not a clinician, but I'd like to think that I know enough to be dangerous in this subject. let me get to like what the options are now, and the recommendations. So the screening rate in terms of like the gold standard for screening for colorectal cancer remains colonoscopy. And that's why, you know, the government agencies, ACS, like everyone moved towards lowering the screening age to 45 from 50, which was great, right? Mm. So if you're average risk and you don't have family history, meaning you're not symptomatic and you don't have a family history of colorectal cancer, then the recommendation now is to have a colonoscopy at 45. Mm-hmm. We know that there's, you know, millions of folks that aren't doing that. But that is the recommendation because colonoscopy is still the screening method that best detects precancerous polyps. Getting to polyps and having them removed before they develop into a cancer versus the other tests that are mostly just going to detect cancer, right? So I always tell people, like, if you're average risk, no symptoms, no family history, you need to get that colonoscopy. And they also face barriers there in terms of waiting times. Hopefully we've close the loopholes in terms of surprise costs. But like people are being told they need to wait 6 months, 12 months, 18 months to get in for a colonoscopy. And, you know, we need to push for better there. So the other methods of testing that are available now are the FIT test, which basically detects, you know, blood in the stool. And also like a Cologuard test, which is a stool-based test, looking for alterations in DNA and blood in the stool. Those are really good tests. I definitely support the Cologuard test because it's going to detect, most of the time, very, very high sensitivity for detecting cancer. So we know that adherence rate is a problem. So, and especially for colonoscopy. So people who are due for it, are resisting doing it because they've heard horror stories about the prep, or they have, you know, had a friend do it and it was a horrible experience, or, you know, a lot of this gets into my lane dealing with men, is that a lot of men are not going to complete a screening procedure if it involves like a breach of the rectum or the anus. And we're talking, you know, you're getting into masculinity norms there, which still persist and exist in 2024, where a lot of guys are like, nope, nothing's going up my butt. Literally, you know, I've had people who've known me and know my story, right, of going through all this stuff with my cancer, and they still won't do it because they're, you know, afraid, you know, that they don't want to do that. So we have these backups, right? We also have blood tests that are emerging. Garden is coming, has the Shield test that's going to be under review by the FDA. It's already commercially available. Very, very sensitive in detecting cancers, colorectal cancer, especially stages 2 through 4. So if you have a cancer, it's going to pretty much get it. And I love seeing that too, but that's also indicated for 45 and up. So here's the problem we get into. Colonoscopy, 45. Blood test, 45 and up. FIT, 45. Like, we've lowered the age by 5 years, but what is that doing for the thousands of people in their 20s, in their 30s, in their 40s, who are getting diagnosed with colorectal cancer? And I have to tell you, you know, I can put faces to Dr. Flora's stats. Sadly, people in their 20s, 30s, young parents, people who are just getting engaged, people who have their whole lives ahead of them are getting diagnosed with CRC. And I have to say, many of the people that I have known, so I've been introduced to dozens, if not hundreds, of these young onset CRC patients over the past 6 years through my work and, you know, as an advocate. And many of them do not have the red flags that we are talking about when we look at what you would normally look at for CRC, like diets high in processed foods or red meats, environmental exposures. A lot of them are marathoners or swimmers and have eaten clean, like, you know, athletes, football players, like the type of people, you know. So we get into this like ideas around the myths around CRC. It used to be this, you know, used to think of it as this old man's disease. Number one, it's almost 50% women. And number two, we are seeing these thousands of cases in these younger people who are otherwise healthy. And that to me is scary. So we don't, as a culture, as a society, we do not currently have screening protocols for that 18 to 45. So the way that we're handling it now is that people are still going to their PCPs and complaining of symptoms. People are going to specialists and they are still getting told, you're too young for CRC. It's probably hemorrhoids. It's probably this. It might be mental health. You know, they're still getting pushed away so that when they do return to, you know, 6 months later, a year later, 2 years later with worsening symptoms, they are presenting at advanced stage 3 or stage 4 disease. And this is the problem that we see everywhere, is like, how do we create a protocol that's appropriate for that younger age group that's going to, you know, because not everyone should get a colonoscopy, right? And not everyone should get a test, but we have nothing for them. We have nothing for that under 45 group other than, hey, if you have symptoms and we list the symptoms, or if you have a family history, go talk to your primary care physician or talk to a gastroenterologist about your situation and hope that they can get you through the system. Hope that they can overcome those barriers and get you a colonoscopy. Hope that they can at least do a Cologuard test or a FIT test, because too many times these young people are being ignored until it's too late. And this is the thing about CRC, is it's highly treatable, highly curable stages 1 through 3. 70 to 90+%, right? Where you're going to live and you're going to see those, you're going to raise your kids and you're going to do all the things that you should do as a relatively young adult. But when you get to stage 4, when it metastasizes, the 5-year overall survival rate for CRC is still under 15%. And that's a shocking, right? And it hasn't changed much in the time that I've had it. So
It's all shocking. Trevor, super informative. You know, I think the thing we can hope for is is the key word we always talk about, which is access, and through things like blood tests, you know, tests that are easier, yeah, and obviously talking about it more.
And awareness helps, like you said, like, yeah, if we can get more community practitioners and PCPs to understand what's happening with the trend, then mm-hmm, maybe they can help shepherd these younger people through the process to getting the screening that's appropriate. But I think, you know, and some people are saying like, we need to drop the screening age to 20 or whatever. And like, it doesn't, so mm-hmm, I don't know the answers,
right,
Karen? Yeah. Like, I don't know what the solution is, but doing nothing is not a solution.
Well, and I think the solution is being your own advocate, like not just dismissing the one doctor's visit if problems continue, obviously, because like you said, it's like breast cancer and we're catching up to that perhaps, where if it's found early, obviously there's also in breast cancer a lot more treatment options available because there's been so much research. So
yes.
With the explosion of new data and biomarkers in cancer today, how can healthcare professionals keep pace to know which genes will best inform treatment decisions? Trapelo knows. Trapelo is the first single technology platform used by oncologists, labs, and payers to resolve the complexities of precision medicine in real time. Trapelo knows which patients to test and when. It knows which tests are most appropriate, which labs are preferred, and which treatments are most likely to be reimbursed. Visit TrapelloHealth.com to learn how you can give cancer patients the most appropriate, evidence-based treatment options when time matters most.
So I wanted to just transition into treatment a little bit. We've talked about breast cancer. Another area we talk about a lot on the podcast is lung cancer. And like lung cancer, colorectal cancers have mutational signatures or abnormal antigens expressed on the surface of tumor cells. Mm-hmm. And the presence of those signatures indicates that immunotherapies, which activate or suppress the immune system, may be effective treatments. I know that's something that you've kind of checked all the boxes: surgery, chemotherapy, immunotherapy, and a clinical trial. Lucky you. Can you just talk about immunotherapy and CRC a little bit? Explain what it is and how effective it is.
Yeah, I mean, unfortunately, immunotherapy holds tremendous promise and is very effective in CRC, but only for a very small percentage. So under 10%, probably more like 5% for those who can get durable remissions or cures through immunotherapy. And mostly those are the people who are microsatellite instable, or what we call MSI high. And that's something that is a biomarker that's pan-tumor, right? We're looking at MSI high versus MSS across the tumor spectrum. But in colorectal cancer, generally most tumors are what they call cold. You know, they are not immunogenic. They are not responsive to the you know, even the latest developed immunotherapies. However, you know, and I think, and that's been the big push since I've become a patient 6 years ago. It is all about how do we turn these, you know, MSS tumors, which are the vast majority of CRC tumors, how do we turn them hot? How do we make them visible to the immune system? And are there new immunotherapies coming down the pipeline, or can we combine the immunotherapies, especially, you know, PD-1 inhibitors, particularly in CTLA-4 inhibitors, and can we combine those with chemotherapies to achieve stability or regression, you know, in these tumors? And let me back up for a minute. So I am one of these MSI high people. When people ask me, how are you still here after 6 years? You know, the 15% thing, I always say number one is my biological luck. I happen to have a cancer. I happen to be MSI high. I happen to have Lynch syndrome, which accounts for about 2-4%. I think that's still the percentage of colorectal cancers are caused from Lynch syndrome. And for those viewers, you know, or listeners who may not be familiar, real quick, it's just I have inherited a faulty gene that makes me more predisposed to developing a cancer. It runs in my family. And this is an interesting question. Like, my dad had Lynch syndrome. We learned after I got diagnosed, and that we have many people in my family who have the genetic defect, if you will, or variant or mutation, which is on the PMS2 gene for our family. But none of them got, right? I was the only one to get young onset CRC. So something else happened, like some type of environmental insult or something to trigger the loss of the full loss of my gene. So I have been fortunate because when I, the first couple of years of my disease, I tried curative surgery. So I had disease that started in my colon and spread to my liver, which is very typical of CRC, and tried a couple of curative surgeries that didn't work. And when that happened, I went on immunotherapy. I was on a combo immunotherapy that basically cured my liver. I had lesions in my liver and they basically disappeared.
Wow.
But I also had that by that time disease that had spread into my peritoneum, and the immunotherapy helped with some of those nodules or tumors, but some of them were not, had no response to the immunotherapy. And it could be a combination just that with the blood uptake that wasn't getting in there, but also there's some heterogeneity of the tumor environment for peritoneal metastases. So that's a long way of saying I'm still here after 6 years because I have a Lynch syndrome and MSI high that allowed me to respond really well to immunotherapy. And now I've been managing my peritoneal disease with other methods, mostly surgery. But back to the original point, chemotherapy, the chemo combos. So there's been some promising advances. Like there's a new combo right now that is showing, I don't know if I can say the name, but it's I believe the company's Agenus or Agenus. It's a new version of a CTLA-4 and PD-1 inhibitor, and that's showing some really good success with MSS cancers. For some patients, they're finding long-term stability on it. So that's promising. But I would say in general, unless I have missed something huge, their immunotherapy has not played the role that many had hoped that it would within the CRC community. And that's kind of unfortunate because there's great promise. And again, for some, especially MSI high, there are folks who have been cured, but even the majority of MSI high people who show an initial response on immunotherapy will go on to progress at some point. So that's my like overview of the landscape of immunotherapy for CRC. And there's so many trials, right? Like the number of trials that are happening, the number of combos that are being put together are light years ahead of where they were even a decade ago. So I'm very positive around it. I'm very hopeful that, you know, next generation immunotherapies will make a difference in CRC and kind of crack that code for turning cold tumors hot.
As you mentioned, the good fortune perhaps is that the speed of innovation is happening faster and faster, right? And I'm sure you know as well many friends that are just in the next right place to be biologically lucky, if you will, and have that next therapy available. And so, yeah, so you just touched on where I was going to go next, which is talking about personalized medicine, the advancements there through genetic testing, genomic testing, and how biomarkers enable more precision in the diagnosis and the prognosis and treatment of cancers. I mean, look, we have a whole podcast here dedicated to it. So do you feel like we are adequately communicating to the masses the possibilities of biomarker testing and genetic testing, and that people are taking advantage of it? And especially in colorectal cancer?
This is probably something you hear as a theme on this show, but I think it depends where you live. You know, if you're treated, if you're fortunate enough to be connected to an NCI center, if you're seeing a gastroenterology, you know, department there that focuses on CRC, you're probably going to have that education around, you know, why MSI matters, why different biomarkers matter, targeted therapies, depending on your genetic genomic profile, you know, you'll have that sequencing done and hopefully it'll be communicated to you in a way that you can understand. You know, this also brings up a split of the type of patients there are, you know, some patients, I think there's a trend towards the empowered patient these days that wants to be a partner in their decision-making, wants to understand what's happening, try to at least understand from a layperson's perspective what's going on with the medicines and the treatments they're taking. Others just want to go in and say, you know, just tell me what to do, doc. Right.
Right.
But I would say, you know, at those major centers, it's definitely happening. My concern is for those who are being treated in the community. And I think this is scattershot. I think there's some community clinicians and practices that do a really great job being up to date on what's happening with biomarkers and precision medicine and offering those things, or even collaborating with NCI centers for that type of learning. But I think in general, you know, I lead a patient community of about 2,500 plus men, and I'd say 80%+ of them are treated at the community level. And I get the feedback from a lot of them that a lot of this stuff just isn't happening. Their practices are completely overwhelmed. You know, they're on 10 or 15 minute appointment times with their clinicians. And, you know, it's just like, how do we try to save my life today? And they're not getting a lot of that information. And maybe some of these tests are happening at the community level, but the communication is not happening with the patient. So I often see, and again, like I'm practitioner supportive. The practitioners at the community level are drinking from the fire hose. They have their caseloads are too high, and they don't have that extra time or resources to spend, especially when they're a generalist focusing on multiple types of cancer. You know, they could, there's no way that they can keep up with the pace of information that's happening. Even some of the basic things that should be expected now. So I think that's where we get into this patient to patient movement. And when I say that, you know, I would call that the sharing of information, resources, referrals in real time between patients across the country and the world. And so, you know, that your practitioner has a limited time to spend with you, and you ask the questions that you can. But for those of us who really want to, you know, spend that extra time on our case, we're going to go into these patient forums and learn about what's happening in other centers, learn about what other patients are doing, learn about what combos are having success. And then we go back to our practitioners and say, hey, you know, have you heard about this? What's going on with this? You know, I'll give an example. You know, we have a younger guy in our group and is diagnosed with stage 4 advanced CRC in his 30s, basically told by his community center that get his affairs in order, that he's chemo for life. And there was nothing they could offer him. And he decided by participating in the patient to patient movement and learning from other patients who are at different centers and what the options are, he got second opinions and went to a center where they offered him, they offered him a mode of treatment. Like in his case, it was the HAI pump, and he's coming up on 3 years cancer-free, after treatment with the pump. So, and that's not the only modality, but my point is we're still seeing a lot of patients who are told at the community level that they have limited or no options. And then they get their second opinions, and all of a sudden those options open up, whether it be liver transplant, which is happening more and more, especially in Rochester with Dr. Hernandez, or the pump, which is done at multiple centers, or different combos or different trials. You know, that's one thing with patients. Like if we're told by one center that they don't have a trial for us, they don't have the time or resources to tell us what's going on at other centers. Like, and it can be very siloed. So that's when it just gets into like, we need to work as partners, because I think your original question around what are patients learning, you know, about precision medicine when it comes to CRC, I think it all depends on where they're being treated. But I think it also depends on if they're participating in patient-to-patient knowledge. You know, I'll give you another great example. Like ColonTown is an amazing resource for people with CRC, and it's run by amazingly science-minded CRC patients, caregivers, survivors, and they have a spreadsheet, the Alana Project, where people can self-report about the trials that they're on and what they're going through and their side effects and their responses. So a patient could be looking at a trial and maybe go see, oh, there's 10 people on this trial and here's how they're doing, rather than waiting 3 years for data to come out. You know, and it's, maybe it's not the... Maybe that's not the, you know, no one's trying to be a doctor here, but I think patients deserve to have informed information. And a lot of times these days, based on the ability to communicate and the ability of patients to really become empowered and learn you're seeing that accelerate really quickly.
For sure.
So that we can be partners with those practitioners at the community and NCI level.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it's important too to recognize sometimes that it's not just the patients, that sometimes folks are getting into trials because they have a family member that is that has the time and can be that, you know, stating the obvious. But yeah, I think what we keep saying here in this episode is just awareness for the patient, and that it sounds silly, but you do have to be your own advocate, because oncologists are seeing multiple cancer patients, and to never be afraid of being that advocate and asking the same question over and going too far, right? Asking too many questions.
You have to, you have to be that squeaky wheel, because in a very respectful way, of course, like they're doing their best. And again, I have no knockout, like these practitioners are saviors and they save lives every day. But as a patient, if you, no one's going to take your case or your survival, you know, no one has the capacity to put as much energy or work into that as you do. And so, you know, I liken it to, if you want to build your own house, you can hire an architect, but if you're someone who really loves architecture and getting involved in that, you're going to be that partner for that architect and be like, I'm going to learn about this as much as I can. Mm-hmm. Or if you're, let's say you get charged with a crime, and your lawyer is trying to help you out, but he's swamped. You better bet you're gonna learn about the law and try to figure it out. I think in the old days it was more paternalistic, like we're the doctors, you the patient, just do what I say, right? But now, especially like when doctors can't keep up, the patients, we need to step into that gap and help. And and I think you have every right to learn about your disease, to ask questions about your disease, to be a co-pilot in your care, right? I say my oncology team or my surgeon, like my medical team, maybe the CEO, but I'm COO and I'm going to, like, no decision's going to be made without me. And also the importance of second opinions. Like there's been one case with my care where I've had three different opinions that were pretty, you know, vastly different from three different centers. So I think, and this gets into the guy thing again, is like a lot of men think, well, if my community doctor says this, then he knows everything that's going on in the field. And it's no offense to that community doctor, but they can't possibly know. So it's your job as a patient to get those second opinions, be the squeaky wheel, ask the questions, connect with other patients. And sadly, like, you know, in Trevor's ideal world, which probably no one wants to live in, but in my ideal world, we would all have navigators, right? And I know this is a hot topic too. It's like we would all have a neutral navigator who is not aligned with any business or hospital, but it's their job to shepherd us through these life-changing, life-saving decisions, because by getting second opinions, I've saved my own life.
And for sure.
But I'm lucky because I've had my wife has been the breadwinner. She carries our insurance. I was on disability for quite some time and I was able to take the time to do those things. Mm-hmm. I was able to get, and also I have privilege. I'm able to connect with people and get answers, right? You know, as a white male, I also have privilege there. And acknowledge that, but everyone should have that opportunity, right? Everyone should be on the same footing when it comes to getting the best care.
Definitely. Well, I want to still ask you this next question. We covered a lot just now in it, but I think, you know, so I'm just going to throw this out there ahead. So Trevor and I both live in a rural state, the great state of Maine. Yeah. Many of our listeners know I'm a cancer survivor as well. So we were diagnosed in the community and treated in the community. And, you know, it is a challenge when you've been living with cancer for 6 years. Getting treatment for cancer can be a full-time job as a patient and for your immediate family members. So let's dig into a little bit more of the other aspects, but how can families and patients with lower average incomes and education get the best care when maybe they can't travel, let's just say long distances, or take weeks off from work, or find time to read and absorb literature or understand medical terminology from your perspective? We do talk about this a lot. It's important. How do we ensure more equitable access for patients with CRC?
I mean, I think it's sad that this is the answer, but usually it's through advocacy organizations. Usually it's not through like the medical industrial complex, just because the way that complex works, like you almost need a champion, right? Like you almost need someone who has walked that walk, who speaks that. It's a very particular language, right? In healthcare. And most of us, like, you know, I'm thinking about my group, 2,500 plus guys who are, you know, the scientific literacy, like these are, we're not professors. So for many of us, like that scientific literacy is low, and the ability to go get that when you're working a job or two jobs, it's almost impossible. So, you know, I always recommend for people who are newly diagnosed and they need that champion or they need someone to help walk them through it, I always connect them to ColonTown and Fight CRC and Colon Cancer Coalition and other groups and tell them, like, hey, when you get in touch with these people, tell them I am struggling financially, which most people going through this are. I am struggling with understanding what my options are. I'm struggling in understanding how to move through this process and then with insurance and everything else. What are the ways in your organization that you have to help me? And amazingly, these organizations, even though they have to claw and dig and fight for resources, they have people and they have volunteers and they have other patients who can help with that navigation. So I think navigation is critical because it's not realistic for us to ask a typical cancer patient who still needs to work while they're going through chemo and maybe doesn't have the education or capacity to learn all this complex science stuff. You know, it's unfair to ask them to have to do that on their own. So fortunately, some of these organizations do bridge that gap, and we're really fortunate to have them.
Well, I think it comes down to time and of course expertise, because it's not fair to expect that of a family member either, friend, right?
And that's how it's being done. It's like Band-Aids and you know, duct tape and bubble gum. Like, hey, do you know, this is it. Like patients are like, oh, I have a cousin or I have a cousin's boyfriend who is a oncology nurse, and they're taking time out of their day to walk these people through this decision making because their practices just don't have the time and resources to take it to the next level. And that's the reality on the ground.
Thank you for joining us for part one of my conversation with Trevor Maxwell, CRC patient advocate and founder of Man Up to Cancer. Coming up in part two, Trevor shares learning of his stage 4 cancer diagnosis, the darkness he faced during his mental health struggle, and how he himself found a way to man up to cancer. We hope you'll tune in.
You've been listening to the Precision Medicine Podcast, sponsored by Trapelo. Trapelo is the first clinical decision support tool to align the interests of oncologists, labs, and payers to give patients the best chance at beating cancer. To learn more, visit gettrapelo.com. To subscribe to the podcast or download transcripts of any episode, visit precisionmedicinepodcast.com. We invite you to join the conversation on social media. You can find us on Twitter at PMP by Trapelo and on LinkedIn at the Trapelo company page. If you know someone who would enjoy the Precision Medicine Podcast, please share it. They'll thank you, and so will we. We hope you'll tune in for the next episode.